You're listening to the Master Passive Income Podcast Network.
Charles Rose Jr. with Breakthrough Investor, where we help you break through that next level as an investor. And with me today is William Palmer, real estate investor, coach, and the amazing co-host of Breakthrough Investor.
Welcome to the Breakthrough Investor Show, where we guide you to financial freedom and break barriers in your investing to give you the secrets to success. And now, here are your hosts, Charles Rose Jr. and William Palmer.
William, what's up, brother? How fantastic are you doing today?
I am fantastic as always, Charles. Super excited about today's interview. This guy has kind of done a little bit of everything, it seems like, and super, super interested to hear about how he went from being a full-time firefighter to getting about $70 million in his real estate portfolio. Like, that's an amazing jump. I don't care if you've had 40 years in which to do it. That's still amazing. So really looking forward to that. He's been into self-storage, wholesaling, real estate development, and you don't hear a whole lot about is distressed debt. So actually, I'm not too familiar with that, so I might have to ask him about that. But really interested how he got started and then kind of some of those roadblocks that he's had to overcome.
Yeah, man, absolutely. I'm super excited too, because you know, one of the things you mentioned that, you know, he started as a firefighter, but you know, I think there's a key word missing. He started as a broke firefighter with his business partner. And so, like you, William, I am super excited to hear more of his story. I'm sure our audience will too, because you know, starting from zero, man, that's a story to tell. So I don't know about Absolutely. You, but I think I just want to hear it directly from him. How about that?
100%. Let's get it going.
All right. Well, help me welcome our guest to the show today, which is Ian Horowitz. What's up, man?
What's up, boys? How you doing? I know we're recording this a little bit after Christmas. I'm excited for the end of year stuff, excited for the new year stuff. Hoping 2024 is going to be a great year. And I'm pumped to talk about, you know, everything that we've done and hopefully can motivate some people in the audience to go out and do something big also.
Awesome. Man. Yeah, man. We're super excited to hear your story, man. Like, you know, how you went from, you know, a broke firefighter to just where you are today. So tell us more about your investing journey and what initially made you decide to do it.
Yeah, so I'll take it back a little bit. You know, my business partner and I, we both really wanted to be big city firemen. We grew up outside of Philadelphia. The problem with trying to become a Philadelphia fireman was you had to live in the city. So us and a few of our other friends, we wound up getting hired in Baltimore City, and we went down there and we became firemen. And it ultimately, you know, we thought it was the world's greatest job. We got to help people. We got to, you know, do what we love. It's something that we always wanted to do. But there was one problem. We got hired in 2007 and 2008. It wasn't the best financial times. And, you know, from the academy, we got furloughed. They changed our health care. They changed our schedules. They were closing companies. All these crazy things were going on. And I said, dude, there has to be a better way. You know, we were working 2 10-hour days, 2 14-hour nights. And then I was working side work before my night works and then all my 4 days off. So I went from working 5 days a week to working 8 days a week, still trying to make ends meet. And look, I get it. You give up a lot of things to go be a city worker, right? You expect consistent pay, a secure retirement, great healthcare. Well, all that stuff's just being evaporated. And then there was a few things that happened, but one of them was I was laying in bed one night at work. And I'm like, dude, how do I make money while I'm asleep, while I'm at work? How do I leave a legacy? God forbid I get killed in my job. Let's say I become dismembered. You know, we're in a line of work that we could be killed, that anything can change at a moment's notice. And I said, what if? And what if I want to have kids? What if I want to do all these things? How do I make sure that my wife is secure, my kids are secured, should something happen to me? And I said, well, at least with real estate, she can collect the rent. She paid off. Someone's living in that house. If I'm sleeping at work, I'm still making money. I am literally making money around the clock. And there's not much effort that needs to be put in besides that initial effort. And that's really what got me over the hump. There was a few other factors that came with that. You know, they were messing with our pension. Pension systems are going bankrupt all over the country in California, Detroit, private industries. And I was like, dude, I have to secure my retirement. I have to take care of my family. God forbid something happens to me. And that's what led me to investing in real estate.
Man, what a story, man. Man, So tell us, let's unpack that journey a little bit more. So you were at this point where, you know, things, you know, you're about to lose your pension. And that's another story for another day, William. You know, with pension and retirement packages that really aren't secure. But what was like, what was going through your mind at that time? And what made you decide to get into real estate versus all of the other alternative investing assets out there?
Yeah, and I would say, look, I'm not a God person by any means. No disrespect to people that are very into religion. I'm very much a universe person. And for whatever reason, all these things were happening to me in 2012-ish, 2011-ish. We're working all the time. My in-laws, they used to sell and service outdoor power equipment. They had a guy that just stopped buying equipment from them. They said, hey, man, what happened? He's like, well, I kept buying a house a year for 30 years, and I did Section 8 rentals, and guess what? I don't have to work anymore. I sold my landscaping business. I'm done. I was like, wow, that sounds amazing. Then, you know, I was working one day, and there was a guy who was on the job for almost 40 years. He wound up working almost 50 years. And I said, Lieutenant, I said, you've been here for 40 years. Why have you not retired? You're losing money. And he was just so institutionalized that he couldn't leave. And I was like, I am not that guy. I'm never going to be that guy. And then more importantly, like there was other guys that would leave right at 20 or 25 years. I said, oh, cool. What are you going to do? You're going to go travel the world? No, I can't afford that. I'm going to go work at Walmart or Home Depot. I was like, why would you leave one job to go do another job? Like, this doesn't make sense to me. Like, the point of working here is to leave with a great retirement that you get to go enjoy life, because we sacrificed our lives for 25 years. And I just, those things like started really to hit me hard. And then one day I was at work. This is the universe part. I was at work, and one of my buddies said, hey, I'm going to this investor meetup. And I had been doing some studying prior to this. This is 2012. YouTube University is not as big as what it is today. Podcasts aren't what they are today. And I said, sure, Chad, I'll go with you. And we went to this meetup, and the lady, she walks, she's like, hey, I have so-and-so coming to speak. This guy, Pete, he owns a few hundred Section 8 rentals. He's going to come talk to us about speaking. And I was like, holy shit. Like, I can't believe I got to come to this. I'm so glad I said yes. Well, it turns out it was one of those like selling electric Ponzi scheme things or whatever. And I was like, dude, I don't want to hear about this. So I said, hey, man, I said, you want to go grab a beer? I really want to learn what you do and how you invest in real estate. And he just took me under his wing. I don't know why he felt an affinity to help me. And I said, dude, I'm serious. And a couple of weeks later, he called me with our first property. And he said, hey, I got this property. It's 25 grand. You should really buy it. I think you get $1,250 rent on it if you fix it up. I said, there's no way. And he's like, yeah, dude, you need like 25, 30 grand to put into it and you'll be fine. And we took that risk. I mean, dude, you guys got to remember, I know I'm rambling on here and you can stop me whenever you want. My credit score is 570 at that point. You know, my whole theory was like, look, if I go broke, like screw it. Like, let's just go do it, man. Like I tell everybody, go swing the bat, dude. At that point in my life, I'm 30 years old or 29. I said, you know what? If I lose it all and I go bankrupt, I'll just work in the fire department. Like I'm already destitute to do that at this point. Screw it. If I lose it all, it's fine. So we took a risk on that house, bought that first house. We were all in for about $55,000 and we got $1,250 rent. And that first time I made $600 cash flow, dude, it was like crack, man. Like I've never done crack, but I hear it's a great drug. But you know what it is, like the initial high, like I was just hooked, dude. I was like, yo, I got to do this again. And that's really what got us started, you know, just taking that risk, people showing up in our face. And I was like, man, like this must be what we were meant to do. And it really worked out for us.
So everybody listening, basically crack for realtor or a real estate investors is rental passive income.
There you go.
Yeah, I think, oh, dude, you know, I mean, come on, boys, you know, dude, on the first of the month, that money comes in, your bills go out. You're like, cool. What do I got to do the rest of the month? This is amazing. Right. Like, I'm 100%. Sure there's drama. But that cash flow, doing that hard work, man, like sign me up, dude. I'd do it all day, every day. So
yeah, it's amazing, right? Doing like how you put all that, you know, you put all that work up front, which is really not that, you know, not that much, you know, compared to working for a company for 40 years and don't even know if you're going to get a pension. But you put in that work up front and that creates a passive stream of income, right? Which is probably like crack. I've never done crack before too, but like I like the real estate crack.
Well, you know, maybe at a later date or a different lifetime, maybe we'll try it. But I don't plan on doing it anytime soon. But yo, here's the real question. Where's the real risk? I'd sit around the firehouse and tell these guys, and look, I did not work in the best neighborhood in America. Like if you ever watched The Wire, that is where I worked. You saw the riots that happened in Baltimore City. That is where I worked. Like we were in the heart of West Baltimore, like the heart of the problems. So I'd sit around and tell the boys, like, yo, listen, I'm going to go buy a Section 8 house. This is what I'm going to do. Oh, you're going to be a slumlord. You're going to be this. We go into these houses all the time. Why would you want to do that? I said, no, man, like you guys got a misconception. And really, they were basically trying to knock me down because they really wanted to do it, number one. Or number two, they were saying it's too risky. Well, the real risk is working for the man for 40 years and then one day saying, you know what, pension system went bankrupt because we don't pay Social Security, or you didn't put enough money away, or God forbid, like when we quit our jobs 3 months later, three of our closest friends got killed in a fire. Where is the risk? To me, I'd rather take that financial risk of $15,000 or $25,000 and taking a shot. And if it didn't work out, then so what? I'm already on a career trajectory. So plan B actually really outperformed plan A for me on this one. And I think the people that say it's risky to invest in real estate, I think it's risky not to bet on yourself and get out there and go do it.
That's awesome. So Ian, I know you got over the hurdle of like the first house and getting into Section 8 and stuff like that. What kind of projected you, or what took you down the path of, well, $70 million in real estate? Like how did that happen? That is one hell of a jump.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's be clear. This is, you guys are witnessing 10 years of a grind, right? Like if you're watching this or listening to it, if you can't see me, I got gray hair in my beard. I got no hair on the top of my head, right? Like this is 10 years of grind. But with that being said, you know, it was, we did one house and then we did two houses and then we got to 10 houses and then we flipped some single family real estate. Then we built a single family real estate portfolio of almost 100 rental houses. What did we keep doing? We kept doing the same thing over and over and over again, really, really well. And the way I like to create the analogy is, for those of you that don't know, when we go to a fire, we would go to the fire and cannot leave the scene until that thing is completely out. It's been investigated. The emergency has been mitigated. Then we go back to the firehouse. Well, how do you apply that to your business? We would have a fire burning in our portfolio, projects not going well, can't get financing, something blew up, a tenant did this, a blah, 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 that, whatever it is. We were dumb. I like to say it like this. We were dumb enough to get up every single day and go do it over and over and over again until those fires were put out. So we were able to really refine our skills for several years in the single family world. And then what happened was, through natural progression, you know, and some of it was the market pushing us out, some of it was just studying other asset classes, allowed us to go dabble in distressed debt, go dabble in multifamily, go dabble in self-storage, and find out what we're good at and take us to that next level. And really, it was just applying the same skill set. We have a process for our single family. Cool. How do we apply that process to our multifamily? How do we apply that same process to self-storage or commercial assets, raising capital, whatever it is? We learned what we were good at and how we connect with people. And ultimately, we're able to build our portfolio to what it is today, you know, $70 million of asset value. You know, I hope in the next year or two that we could get to that nine-figure mark. But that's powerful, man. I tell all of our investors, I tell everybody that I talk to, any show that I go on, you probably, if you've heard me anywhere else, is like, we're just two dumb firemen. We were willing to outwork everybody else. When there was a problem, we kept going. Most people, when there's a problem, they're like, let me throw money at it. This wasn't meant to be. Screw it. I lost money. This is all bullshit. Everyone on the internet's lying. No, dude, we just worked harder than everybody else and we kept going back at it. And when things weren't going right, we said, you know what? We got into this situation. We're going to grind our way out. And if we don't have money, we have our hands, we have our brains, and let's go do it.
Man, that's a powerful story, man. And you're so right. A lot of people would give up in those situations, man. And did you ever come close to the point where you wanted to give up, and what got you through that? And specifically, maybe even like, you know, tapping into maybe like a mindset challenge that you had to overcome in order to break through as an investor.
Yeah, I mean, really the biggest mindset challenge day one was having the confidence to go do it, right? And then when you go do it, and I'll speak to we'll split the audience here. We'll talk to the guys and gals that haven't done anything. To go do it, I think we hit that hard, is like, it's riskier to work for the man. It's riskier to not take the chance. And once you can mentally cope with it and you've figured out how to break down all the barriers and say, you know what, worst case scenario, I can sell it for the same price. Worst case scenario, I'll rent it forever and I'll just work overtime and I'll just make a cash flow at some point and eventually pay the debt off. There is a way to work through this situation. You need to figure that out. But then as you go through your investing career, what happens a lot and this is the audience that I resonate with also, is like, you got 10 houses, you got 20 houses, you got whatever, and you're like, yo, life's good. I'm going to go sit on the beach. I'm going to go do this. There's not much else to do, is really taking yourself to the next level, because what it takes to go from zero to a million is way different than what it takes to go from a million to 10 million or whatever numbers you want to insert there. Those insert there is zero to one or zero to 5 million. You can just be fast and loose, right? You go do your thing. You got to be fast and loose to get there. 5 to 10 million, you might have to blow up all your processes and start over. And not too many people are willing to get uncomfortable again, because they went from uncomfortable to comfortable. But to go to that next level, you need to get uncomfortable again, blow your systems up, and go get uncomfortable again to get to that next comfort level. And it's a seesaw all the way up. So for us, it's always now, it's more about studying, it's understanding, talking with other operators, figuring out what the downside risk is. You know, like when we were getting to self-storage, it was like, can I buy under replacement cost? If nothing else changes, can I sell it for the same price? You're buying a business, right? Like, those are all mental challenges that we work through to get to that next level. And like I said, too many people are not willing to take the risk to go to the next level. It might be just from 10 houses to 20 houses. You might say, oh, well, if I get to 20 houses, I got to hire a maintenance guy. How am I going to afford that? I'm not going to get any more cash flow. No shit. When you scale, there's going to be this time where it costs you money and you don't really make more. But then you hit the upper end of that scale, and that's what happened to us. When we went from 10 houses to, say, 50 houses, we were able to, like, manage it on the back of a napkin. We were able to do some stuff. Then we had to hire an operations manager to run some of our projects. We're like, how are we going to afford 60 grand a year? I don't know, dude. We'll figure it out. I mean, he makes way more than that today. But, dude, initially, it was one of the scariest hires we made. But the day we made that hire, it freed up a ton of bandwidth to get us to that next level, to get to 100 houses. And sure, the next 10 or 20 houses, we didn't make more money. But the next 20 to 30 houses past that, we made a lot more money because we had a team in place and allowed us to be free to go do more stuff.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That's awesome. How, like, I know, like, the processes and things like that, that's the one thing that I'm not entirely very good at. So how did you guys go about building it? Was it just literally trial and error? Just try it and then adjust, try it and adjust, try it and adjust until you got it dialed in, and then just going from there? Or was there, like, one brainchild that figured it all out real fast?
Yeah, I wish I could say it's like, just open this book and it'll all work out for you. There is no book, dude. Yeah, no, everybody does it different, man. It's, you know, like, and that's why I like listening to podcasts and books and going through other people. And people are like, well, what? How does Warren Buffett relate to you? I'm like, well, he doesn't. I mean, I think he's politically compromised and I have no issues in wanting to be like him. But the one thing you can take away from that man is he has stood the test of time. Sam Zell's book, you know, rest his soul, Am I Too Subtle? Listen to that book. You know what my takeaway from there was? Not that I need to buy a bunch of assets, but he has a bunch of assets with a very small team. How do I recreate that for myself? So really it becomes trial and error amongst your team. Initially, you as the, like, on your first employee, it might help to write out what you do every day and really set some guidelines to what your expectations are, and then loosen that up and really allow your employees to become entrepreneurs and help run the company and help describe what they do every day and start building them. I think now one of this, was it ScribeHow or Scribe? I forget what it's called, but you can literally, it literally follows all your keystrokes. So if, like, I want to show someone how to onboard a new property into our property management software, I type it in there, I follow all my keystrokes, bam, it's in a manual, and we're good to go. And look, it sounds good to have all these manuals, but there's also a lot of fluidness that comes with it. And I think that's one thing that we learned from the fire services. We had operating guidelines. That was just a guideline that everybody should have an idea of how to operate. But then when you get there, everybody's going to do it in a different fashion. It might not be the way you would complete the task, but the task is getting completed. And that's one thing you need to remember when you're hiring, is it's not, you set this guideline. If they don't follow every bullet point, it's like, sorry, dude, you're fired. It's like, okay, you're not following every bullet point, but you're getting it done in a timely fashion in the way that works for you. So be it. Can you document it? So if someone else comes in, maybe they like your way better than my way, or maybe my way is just so out of touch with actually how we're supposed to do it. Can you document your way to do it? So I think getting the employees or your team members, whether it's VAs, stateside employees, other vendors, if they can help you document what they do so you can pass it on to somebody else, now you're creating true legacy and the ability to scale and grow.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome how you mentioned that process. And I think our listeners listening in are going to really like that, because you know, a lot of them are trying to figure out what are the things I need to do to get to my business to that next level. So I appreciate you mentioning that. Now, Ian, I know that you also help other investors invest. And that's one of the cool things I love about you is that y'all help people co-invest in deals. Tell us more about that process and what that looks like.
Yeah. So for us, you know, early on when we were doing single family real estate, it was hard for us to get our friends and family to invest because the cash flow is not gigantic. You know, the capital amounts are still relatively big required to buy some of these properties, even though cash flow is not like gigantic. So we never really found a great way for them to co-invest. But when we started doing multifamily and self-storage and bigger commercial assets, there was room to do it. And for us, it was firemen, teachers, nurses, military. They do not get good looks at these types of opportunities just because they're usually reserved. Let's call it white collar, blue collar here. You know, white collar type, college going, you know, we're just not the demo that people want to attract. So when we got our first big building that we were raising $1 million for, we said, listen, dude, like, I don't know when we're going to get another chance at this. You have to invest. And people were like, yeah, we've watched your success for years. And we allow them to what we call co-invest because we really want them to be a part of the team and understand what they're buying. And you would actually be surprised how many people are actually accredited investors because they married well, family has money, people are really good savers, and they fall into the accreditation piece. And then the ones that don't, we reserve our 35 spots for our closest friends and family who really deserve a shot at these types of opportunities. And for us, it means a lot for them to be able to side by side co-invest with us. And when they're riding by, it's like, yo, I own a piece of that 76 unit apartment building. Hey, I own a part of this 700,000 square foot self-storage portfolio. And really gets people intrigued, because I think now with the internet, social media, people are more in tune that the stock market might just be one massive farce for all we know, that we're really at a disadvantage in that game. Let's find investments that give us a nice, steady return. And that's what we're able to do for our co-investors.
That's awesome, man. So now with these 35 spots for friends and family, do they have like a certain amount, like a certain threshold, or is there a certain amount that they have to put down, or is it like anything?
Yeah. So the accreditation, don't quote me, but the SEC states 200 grand individually, 350 married. Businesses have to be $5 million, I think, to be what they call an accredited investor. To invest into our, I know somebody's going to come on here and be like, oh, you're wrong, but just go Google the SEC and what accreditations are. The 35 spots are reserved for what they call sophisticated investors or non-accredited investors who have a personal relationship to us. So guys that I worked with, guys that I have previous relationships, you know, vendors of ours that we work together on a daily basis that like, I'm like, hey, like, you know what we do, you know how we work. Like, I couldn't take your guy, like, if you weren't accredited, I couldn't take your guy's money. This is the first time we're meeting. We have no previous relationship. From there, each of our investments vary. You know, sometimes it's $10,000, sometimes it's $25,000. It could be, you know, 50 grand. It all kind of depends on what the investment looks like. Right now, we're doing a small capital raise for a new build single family house that we're doing. You know, we're raising $1.25 million and it's all debt. So we just did $10,000 shares because, you know what? I know enough people, it's debt. I don't have to do it in an accreditation standpoint because they're not investing in equity. I know enough people with $10,000 that it's like, hey, just come in. We have the back end software and it's good. I don't need to worry about your accreditation status, and it makes life easier. So it all kind of depends how you lay out the investment, what it is, what the needs are. Look, we'd all much rather raise money from one person at 1.25 and just do it all in one shot and the capital raise is over and done with. But the problem with that is now you're dealing with a shark. I'd rather have the 125 people make my life miserable on the back end. Now I know I have 125 people that have committed $10,000 to us that are willing to jump in the game and play ball. Cool. You know what? One of those $10,000 investors turns into a $500,000 investor. You know, people have more money in the sidelines. They want to dip their toe. And as they dip their toe, they're going to grow with you. You know, you want to prove to them that you're going to do exactly what you said you're going to do. So that's been fun. You know, it's been fun to watch our investments fill up really, really fast. So it gets better every time. It gives us more confidence. You know, the biggest capital raise we've done was like $6 million. You know, that thing filled up in, I don't know, less than 30 days. So that's exciting. Again, two broke firemen. We don't have a huge white collar background. where a bunch of people went to college to go be doctors and nurses and engineers, and they're making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. I mean, we grind out the capital that we raise from our friends and family who are great savers, been better investors, who have married, you know, potentially well. They know people in their network that they're like, hey, my friend wants to invest some money. And that's really how we've been able to do it and grow. And without our co-investors, Dan and I would not be at $70 million worth of assets. I mean, we maybe would be at five or 10 million. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really created, it poured gasoline onto what we're doing and allow us to grow and scale and continue to help additional people.
Wow. I love how you're just grabbing your family and your friends and people you care mm-hmm. about and saying, hey, we're going on this ride. We've already started the train. It's moving. Jump on. Like that is yep. phenomenal. That's going to change so many yeah. people's lives.
I was going to say, a friend of mine who I co-host my podcast with, you know, they've raised almost $50 million and they come from more of a traditional white collar background. And I said, dude, you guys just have a competitive advantage. And they kept saying, no, just keep doing what you're doing. Just keep telling everybody there's enough money in your network. I said, bullshit, bullshit, bullshit. Well, today we've raised almost $20 million of capital, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, they were right. There is enough people in your network and they might not take risk with you on the first one. You might have to give up 70, 80% of the first deal to get somebody juiced enough to go do a deal with you. And then slowly but surely you can work them back to where it needs to be fair, because most people in the end, they want you to make money and we want them to make money, and it needs to be a fair relationship. If it's not, then they're not going to do it or you're not going to do it. But the first few, you might have to be a little bit looser and give them a little more than what they expect. Prove to them that you can do what you say you're going to do, and then continue to grow your capital raising from there.
Mm-hmm. That's some good stuff, man. And I love how you mentioned, like, you could, you know, just target, you know, just a handful of people with a lot of liquidity, a lot of cash, but then you open it up to friends and family and so many people, and you can grow like that. Because I know a lot of people who are raising funds. I know a lot of people, they love to just focus on that small group, and which is, you know, nothing's wrong with that if that works for them. But I love your strategy a lot too, because then you end up having more investors, right? You know, versus, you know, a situation where you may have one or two big investors and they back out of a deal at the last minute. Then all of a sudden you're scrambling, trying to raise money to close this deal, right? So I love your strategy.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, we do a lot of podcast and content and everything on Equity Warehouse, you know, and like we had someone reach out yesterday from YouTube about investing. And I said, listen, man, I don't know you. What I can tell you is sign up on the platform and watch what happens. But like, we need to have additional relationship before we can get into a deal together, because it does make me uncomfortable. In the end, we want our investors to believe in the same principles that we do. If we buy an asset, we might never sell it. We might refinance it. We might do a ton of different things with it, right? It could be anything that we want. But I need them to understand is like, you have the same principal beliefs with us. If we're going to sell it, it's going to be such a windfall that it's a no-brainer for us all to sell it. If we're going to refinance it, it better be producing a ton of cash flow, and it makes so much sense for us to keep it. If we're not going to refinance it, again, there might be so much cash that's coming out that it's a no-brainer for us to do. And really, we want them to have the same core principles, because there's nothing worse than having, in the end, they are business partners. Having a bad business partner who's up your ass all the time that's saying, why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? How's this working? Why is that? Why is this? In the end, you want them to be on your team playing with you, not playing against you. I'm fine with the challenges. We do have a few of our friends that are well-to-do. One of them's a CFO out in California for a medical company who came in through a friend of a friend. But we've become friendly over the years. And he does challenge us of like from a financial standpoint and says, hey, have you guys thought about X or about Y? What does this disposition look like? What if we got more capital back in? Could we do this? He's not getting any additional money on his returns because he's challenging. He's literally just saying, hey, I want to see you guys be successful because I want to keep giving you money because I have a relationship with you. I don't want to work with anyone else but you guys. And I think that's when it becomes really, really, really powerful and things really start to grow and rising tides. What is it? Rising tides float all boats. I don't know. I'm so bad with saying. But you guys are all doing well. We all do better. The end, right? Let's just do it.
Yeah, your story is fantastic, dude. But there's very likely something we might have missed. Is there something that maybe you would like to share with our viewers? Maybe some encouragement or something that we haven't touched on that you think is important?
Yeah, I would say one thing. I'll leave you with two things. One is I would not be here where we are today without my business partner and our operations manager. My partner is Dan Matthey, and my operations manager, who's Ryan Tucker. I would not be where we are today without them, because my personality, if you guys can't tell, is I'm fun, bubbly, outgoing. Everything's going to be fine. Dan is more the CFO type. And he's like, dude, we need money. We need to do this. You're being way too unrealistic. I'm like, okay, you're right. So we checks and balance each other. And then Ryan basically takes what Dan and I talk about and implements it across the portfolio and across the team, and always has our best interest at heart. And one of the things that I would tell everybody to go do is, whether you're hiring, you're looking for a business partner, you're looking for vendors, capital investors, is learn the personality test. It has worked really well for us. I'm a D and an I. You know, D is decisive. I is very outgoing type personality. My business partner is a D and an S, or a D and a C. So he's way more cautious, but he's decisive. And then our operations manager is a D and an S. He's decisive and he's supportive. He wants to support the team and see the team success. And as you start to learn these, you start identifying personalities. It'll help you grow. You're never going to ask a capital investor, hey, take a dispersonality test, or a vendor, hey, take a dispersonality test so you work for me. You can figure out the sales guys really quick and be like, all right, well, he's really salesy. What does his operations team look like? Are they actually going to get my job done for me? So learning the dispersonality test has been something that's been monumental for us. And then past that, you know, what's one tip that I'd leave for the audience? I don't care where you are in your investing careers, whether you're just getting started or you're trying to get to the next level, go swing the bat. If you're trying to get started, go find a deal that makes sense to you. Go do it. Don't let anybody talk shit to you. Just go do it, man. If you think it's right, go do it. It's way more risky to count on someone else than it is to bet on yourself. That's the number one thing that messed me up for a long time, because we should have quit our jobs several years before we quit. And someone kept saying to me, well, you don't want to bet on yourself? I'm like, screw you, Terry. And he's like, come on, man, you should really bet on yourself. I'm like, shit. And the day I quit my job, I was like, shit, I'm betting on myself. And this guy's been right. Like, we tripled our business within 2 years of quitting. And I should have listened to him a long time before that. And then if you are trying to get to the next level, remember what it was like to swing the bat on day one and go apply that to your business to get to the next level. And that's all I got to say. I'm not a huge baseball fan, but swinging the bat is probably one of the best sayings you could put out there, because if you don't do it, man, you're never going to do it. Life's short. I love Jesse Itzler and what he does with that big ass calendar for the whole year. And it's like, dude, when you start thinking about it, dude, you know, I'm 40, you know, I might only have 40 Christmases left. I might only have 40 New Year's left. Like, life is not that long, dude. I hope I have 60 or 100. But in the same sense, it's like, there ain't that many left, dude. So go do it. You can talk about it or you can be about it. Go be about it. Go do it.
Awesome, man. Awesome. Love it, man. Well, this has been absolutely fantastic, Ian. And I know that our listeners are going to want to connect with you more. How can they connect with you more online?
Yeah, if you want to learn more about what we do it, how to become a co-investor, case studies about it, just go check out equitywarehouse.com. We got a bunch of case studies that'll walk you through exactly how we co-invest with our friends and family, or how they co-lend with us. If you want to see some of our social content, just check out Equity Warehouse. We're all over all the social platforms, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, LinkedIn. You'll find us out there. It's the best place to find us. And we have a podcast. It's Real Estate Reserve Podcast. If you're looking for another good podcast to listen to, Jason, who I was telling you about, who's the Hard Money Lender, we co-host that podcast. And we do the same thing you guys do, just bring in real people that are doing real things and just talk shit, because that's the best way to learn, you know, bringing in guys that are real, right? Like, who wants to hear from a guru? I know, you know, tell me how you're, you know, look, I like Grant Cardone, but he's always selling you something. I just want to hear real people are doing real deals. And that's what we do on our shows. So we're out there. If you want to find us, you'll find us. And I really appreciate you guys having me on.